the prime obligation of every human being is to speak out against injustice. We are our brother's keeper.
You're listening to The Keeper, brought to you by the Lantos Foundation for Human Rights and Justice. I'm Katrina Lantos-Sweat. This summer, as part of our special Solidarity Sabbath season, The Keeper is featuring interviews that offer different perspectives on anti-Semitism. Episode 1 gave us background and historical context about anti-Semitism, how this ancient hatred came to be, and why it has endured through the ages. Today, we're going to bring you very much into the 21st century with a conversation I recently had with the United States' top diplomat tasked with combating anti-Semitism. In many ways, this is a chilling and yet critical moment to be on the front lines of the fight against anti-Semitism.
This is an ABC News special report.
Good morning. We're coming on the air right now with breaking news. For those of you watching with young children in the room, you may want to ask them to leave right now. There has been a shooting at a synagogue in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Just moments ago, police reporting there are multiple casualties with three officers shot. The suspect is in custody. This all happening at the Tree of Life Synagogue in the area of Wilkins and Shady Avenues in Pittsburgh's Squirrel Hill neighborhood.
From synagogue shootings to members of Congress openly supporting the boycott, divest, sanction, or BDS movement targeting Israel, to recent studies showing a wave of coronavirus-related anti-Semitism sweeping the globe, this is a time when we desperately need strong voices speaking out against any form of hatred towards Jews or Judaism. Ilan Carr, the U.S. Special Envoy to Monitor and Combat Anti-Semitism, is one such voice. I had the opportunity to speak with him about his work in the fight against anti-Semitism, what keeps him up at night, but also what encourages him and gives him hope for the future. For those of our audience who may not be familiar with the Office of the Special Envoy to Monitor and Combat Anti-Semitism, could you give us sort of the elevator version of what it is your office does?
Our office, as you know very well, was created by Congress in 2004. Congressman Lantos, of course, played a central role in doing this, along with other great leaders, Chris Smith, Mike Pence at the time. And the idea was to create an anti-Semitism watchdog, somebody who would bring the full power of the United States of America to combat this ancient and relentless scourge, this human sickness that recurs generation after generation. And so I'm charged not only with leading U.S. programs to combat anti-Semitism, with advising the Secretary of State on policy regarding anti-Semitism, but I'm also our country's lead diplomat in representing our views on this. It's such a privilege, Katrina, and to do it on an issue that really is about justice. It's about making our world a better place. It really is a privilege to be doing this. And I'm so grateful to Congress, in overwhelming bipartisan support, created this. And I'm so grateful to the support I have. When I go overseas, people know, it's not only the envoy saying this, that when I talk about how much we care about protecting the Jewish people and fighting anti-Semitism, message has gone out very loudly and clearly that my boss and that his boss really care about this. That's really makes my job a whole lot easier.
Now, you've been in your role for a little over a year, I think, and I'd like to know, are there specific trends, are there some particular developments around this issue of global anti-Semitism that keep you up at night?
Well, I think the top concern is that anti-Semitism is rising, and it is rising in all three of the very different ideological camps that drive anti-Semitism and from which anti-Semitism emanates. One camp is the ethnic supremacist far right. You know, this is the anti-Semitism of ominous torchlit marches that call us back to the 1930s. The anti-Semitism of the lone shooters and the synagogue killers. It's the anti-Semitism of the vile, venomous internet chat rooms that boil over with hatred, first and foremost of Jews, really hatred of anybody and everybody that's not like them. And so that's rising. But also the anti-Semitism of the radical left, the anti-Zionist Israel-hating left, is rising. And the anti-Semitism of militant Islamism is rising as well. Now, these are three ideological camps that have very little in common. In fact, one would think they would hate each other more than they hate anything else. And yet, they're bizarrely united by their hatred of the Jewish people. And I would argue, by the way, united also by something else. And that is the fundamental incompatibility of their values with everything on which our country and on which all free-loving countries in the world have been built, which is why really the fight against anti-Semitism is not only a fight for the Jewish people or the fight to protect the Jewish people, it really is a fight for our civilization, for our world, for the kind of world that our children and grandchildren will inherit, because anti-Semitism really is a pernicious evil. So what keeps me up at night is to see it rising from all three of these venomous ideological camps.
It is incredibly disturbing. I wanted to go back to what you said about online hate, because I know that this is something you've been particularly active in drawing attention to. Last year, we at the Lantos Foundation teamed up with Memory, the Middle East Media Research Institute, to publish a report called The Hater Next Door. Talk, if you would, a little bit about the particular challenge for us here in the United States when it comes to combating online hatred.
First of all, thank you for that report, The Hater Next Door, that you did with Memory. We talked about these three diverse ideological camps that spew this Jew hatred. Interestingly enough, they all three use the internet as a primary vector of this poison. So the internet really, for all it's good, and we all know, I mean, the internet and social media is great good for us. And while it is not the cause of anti-Semitism, certainly, it is without question the chief vector of this disease. And that's why it's so important to address it and to deal with it. I'm proud to say that I'm the first special envoy in this role that has one of my deputies, an assistant special envoy, specifically tasked with focusing on internet hate. And that's how seriously we take this, because we understand that we have to unlock this vexing policy challenge of dealing with not only anti-Semitism, but mind you, all kinds of hate that are spreading like wildfire on the internet. You know, let me tell you, a recent European study shows that the period of time it takes to radicalize a young man, and I'm being gender specific for a reason, it's usually men, it's usually young who get lured into these venomous rooms of hate. The amount of time it takes to radicalize a young man online is 25% of the time, so one quarter of the time as it takes to radicalize them offline in the traditional way, you know, rallies and meetings and groups. And so here you have it. I mean, you know, this is a real public policy challenge. Now, we will not ever trample on the First Amendment. It is sacrosanct. But just because we believe in unfettered free speech doesn't mean that there isn't an answer to this. And so we are working on developing policy answers to the policy challenges. And, you know, certainly one of them is to make very clear where that line is between protected free speech and unprotected conduct. For example, incitement to violence is not protected speech. And we have to come together as a society and understand that we've got to come down very, very hard on hate that crosses the line into unprotected conduct. And then second of all, we believe, and First Amendment jurisprudence teaches, the antidote to protected despicable views is protected good views and condemnation. And there we've really got to do a much better job in bringing to bear focused, unequivocal, strong, pointed, and forceful condemnation exactly at the points where that condemnation needs to be brought. That's absolutely critical, that hate be condemned properly. And, you know, the First Amendment protects one from censorship and punishment, doesn't protect one from condemnation. Sometimes the haters claim it does. Every time you try to call them out, they'll say, well, I have free speech rights. Free speech rights doesn't mean you're protected from condemnation. These are all the things we're working on to deal with this great challenge of hate that is spread like wildfire.
Another dimension that I think we at least need to think about, you know, in the aftermath of 9/11, in many ways, our whole society was encouraged to become more alert to the dangers. You'd see it in public transport or at airports. See something, say something. We sort of coined an expression at the Lantos Foundation, read something, report something. If you read something,
Good.
On the internet that is troubling, that sounds threatening, that sounds like it may in fact cross that line, don't just say, oh, that's terrible, and quickly move to some other location because it's upsetting. If it's enough to concern you, then you, as just a responsible citizen, as just a decent person, need to report it, because we do know that sometimes it was telegraphed ahead of time. Should we be doing more? Should we be bringing greater pressure to bear on these social media platforms to better monitor, police, and design their environment so that this kind of speech is not welcome there?
Well, yeah, you know, for pretty much all of these social media platforms, anti-Semitic hate is a violation of their own terms of service. And so I will say that some of these platforms are really making strides and trying to do their as good a job as possible. I met with two tech giants in New York at a forum very ably hosted by the ADL, specifically on internet hate. And I participated, I spoke at that forum. And there are tech giants, social media platforms that are household names, that are really trying to do this and trying to do a better job. I think they have a long way to go, but I think we're seeing some movement in the right direction. And I actually testified on Capitol Hill to this very issue that we are seeing some progress. But again, you know, if you've got a term of use for your platform and people are violating it with not political speech, not political views, you know, we don't want people's views censored. You know, we want social media to be an open place of a marketplace of ideas. When you're talking about a neo-Nazi venom or Jew hatred that focuses instead of the Jew down the street on the Jew among the countries, the Jewish state Israel, or radical Islamism that is the chief source of violence, by the way, for Jews in Western Europe, you know, why would these platforms not enforce their own terms of use? And so there's no question that we have work to do.
Something very current right now, we have seen in the midst of the pandemic, a new surge of old blood libels and conspiracy theories around Jews and their responsibility for this tragic pandemic that has obviously swept the world. Could you talk a little bit for us about the echoes to the past?
Sure. I mean, we've seen a tsunami of anti-Semitism that employs the tragedy of this pandemic to blame and attack Jews. I've heard that Jews invented the virus, that Jews intentionally spread the virus, that the virus is a tool of Jewish world domination, or that it's a tool of Jewish profiteering. A lot of people are saying this is a new version of anti-Semitism, and to which I say, the only thing new or novel about this is the novel coronavirus. Nothing is novel about this. In fact, anti-Semitism throughout history has always seized upon current events and made itself continuously relevant to the times by blaming Jews for what's going on in the world today. The bubonic plague, the Black Death of Europe, was blamed on Jews and poisoning wells, right? That led to all kinds of untold violence against Jewish communities. We've seen this throughout the ages, and we're seeing it today all over the internet, blaming Jews for this. What is particularly troubling is not this kind of lone wolves that are doing this. We actually have state actors and quasi-state actors doing this. One of the chief culprits for this is the Islamic Republic of Iran that has been driving this, like so many other venomous anti-Semitic statements, and they're experts at it. But we've seen them driving this narrative as well, blaming Jews for the coronavirus. In terms of quasi-state actors, the Palestinian authorities, Exhibit A, constantly blaming Jews for intentionally infecting Palestinians with virus. Just appalling canards. My team and I are focused on this. But over the long term, this virus, God willing, soon will be over and done with. It'll be in the rearview mirror. But what will be, I fear, longer lived is the profound economic dislocation that the global shutdown has caused. Throughout every period in history, when there has been real economic suffering, and my heart goes out to people who are really hurting, we've always seen anti-Semitism not only increase, but turn violent. Over the long term, what my team and I are focused on is developing a strategy to deal with what we fear will be coming, which is an increase in anti-Semitism from severe economic hardship that we're seeing all over the world. And that is something we cannot allow. People's genuine, legitimate suffering to be turned on the Jewish people and to be used as a weapon, either of rhetoric or of violence against the Jewish people. It's unacceptable, and we're focused on that.
Well, thank goodness you are. You know, it brings to mind the famous quote that those who do not learn from history are doomed to repeat it. But I think of another quote, I think this one from Mark Twain, who said that history doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes. Not that long ago, there was a rhyme in Ukraine where a local police inspector was demanding lists of Jews in his community. Was this something your office got engaged in?
Yes, we engaged. And not only did my team and I engage, Bureau of Democracy, Human Rights, and Labor at State engaged, other offices, or Religious Freedom. So this was kind of a full court press. It was shocking. It was unacceptable. But let me be clear, it was not authorized by the higher levels of government. It was a local police commander who acted on his own. He was not only disciplined, an investigation was launched, and he was fired. And so we did engage right away. We were very grateful. I mean, you know, look, it was unacceptable. It should never have happened. It raises questions about proper training for police personnel at all levels. And I think hopefully those things will happen. We're continuing to engage with Ukraine, by the way. But let me be clear, Ukraine responded very, very well and very quickly to this. Ukraine is a country that just elected a year ago a Jewish president. And not only did they elect a Jewish president, but his Jewishness, he ran against the incumbent president, and polls before the election showed him leading by 30 points. And despite the fact that you had a Jewish challenger to the sitting president, his Jewishness, President Zelensky's Jewishness, never came up in the campaign. It wasn't an issue.
That's progress in a country with Ukraine's history. We have to acknowledge that's extraordinary progress.
I've been talking about this all around the world, talking about how we focus on the bad news, and we should, right? In order to make the world better, you've got to focus on bad things to fix them. But we can't neglect to appreciate and mention and celebrate and champion the good news. And there's a lot of good news. I mean, Ukraine is a perfect example. Exhibit A, in collaboration with the Nazis during the Holocaust. And now it's just extraordinary where they are and where they've come. And in fact, not only is the president Jewish, but at the time the prime minister was. And Ukraine was fond of saying, there's only one other country in the world that has a Jewish president and a Jewish prime minister. And so really, I mean, you know, Ukraine is doing a lot of things right. And I had a great visit there. I met with the interior minister, Minister Avakov, who deeply cares about this issue. Well, again, this is unacceptable that this should happen in any country. Ukraine responded very quickly and very well to this, and we're grateful for that. Poland has trained 100,000 of its police officers in hate crimes, investigations, and prosecution. Hungary rewrote its educational curriculum. And in fact, Hungary and Austria are standing almost single-handedly. Those two countries, Hungary and Austria, are fighting for the state of Israel in the EU every day. When some EU countries want to single out Israel and treat Israel unfairly, Hungary and Austria have been standing up fighting for Israel, saying, we won't let you do that. I'm very grateful to those two countries for doing that. So that's good news. Another piece of good news is in France, every single police cadet in the country and every single prosecutor cadet in the country is now going through focused training on hate crimes investigation and prosecution, including anti-Semitism. Germany not only has a federal anti-Semitism coordinator, but has federalized that. So now 16 separate German states have anti-Semitism coordinators that bring focus to this. Germany, about 9 months ago, passed a law saying that BDS is anti-Semitism. The Bundestag did that. Austria, more recently, 3 months ago, did the very same thing. Austria said BDS is anti-Semitism. The French National Assembly passed a bill that talked about anti-Semitism. Britain, in a stunning election result, made a very clear statement about the kind of Britain Brits want to see. And in exit polls, Katrina, and this is even more beautiful than anything else, in exit polls from that election, ordinary, everyday Brits said that anti-Semitism was a factor in their vote. They said that this is not the country we want to see. We don't want our children to inherit a country led by anti-Semitism. And so they resoundingly rejected it. And then you've got leaders like Lords Mann and Pickles in the UK, Frédéric Poitier in France, Felix Klein in Germany, who just made a courageous stand against BDS. He said, I won't endorse a BDS trafficker in BDS to be part of a conference. Katrina von Schnurbein, the EU anti-Semitism coordinator, who arranged a deal with internet companies in Europe to remove anti-Semitic content. The list goes on and on. There is so much good news out there because people get it. People get it that it can't be the case that 75 years after the Nazi crematoria stopped operating, you're going to see anti-Semitism rising throughout the world, even in Europe, even in the United States. It can't be. And so you've got real leaders who are fighting. So That's piece of good news number one. Piece of good news number two is that the Jewish people do have self-determination. The state of Israel does exist, and Jewish sovereignty is represented by a country that's a beacon of democracy and justice and world-changing innovation. And Israel's success and strength make the Jewish people stronger and better able to combat anti-Semitism.
We know that you're situated in the State Department and you're a special envoy, which of course implies that your work is overwhelmingly focused outward. But one of the areas of greatest concern in terms of domestic anti-Semitism is what's going on college campuses here in the United States. President Trump signed in December of last year an executive order focused on turning up the heat on college administrations to fight anti-Semitism on campus. Could you explain a little bit about what that executive order was? Maybe tell us a little bit why some people felt it was problematic and how you view it. Is that an issue that you engage with? And could you talk a bit about that?
First of all, let me say that you made the domestic foreign divide, which is valid, but I want you to know, and I want our audience to know, what I hear from Jewish student leaders in the United States is exactly what I hear from Jewish student leaders in France and in the UK and in other countries. They all say the same thing, which is on many, many campuses, far too many, if you want to be safe as a Jewish student, you have to divorce yourself completely from any connection to Israel. And you certainly can't use the Z word, Zionism. You are literally endangering yourself. And that's the case on too many campuses in the United States and too many campuses overseas. It's the very same thing I'm hearing. And yes, President Trump said, enough is enough. I will no longer allow the United States to fund anti-Semitism. And so in signing that executive order, he applied Title VI civil rights protections to Jewish students and adopted the standard international definition of anti-Semitism, the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance, or IHRA, definition of anti-Semitism. We in the State Department have been using it for years, but in the executive order now adopts it for the federal government, for the interagency. And so in doing those two things, it's a game changer.
I'm going to ask you to explain a little bit more, if you would, about the importance of this shared definition of anti-Semitism that was adopted by IHRA, International Holocaust Remembrance Association. Why does a shared definition help in the work that you do, help globally in the fight against anti-Semitism, and how much of your time is spent encouraging other countries to adopt this definition? Because as you say, if they buy into this definition, which includes some elements of vicious vitriolic anti-Zionism under that rubric of anti-Semitism, it really can be a game changer.
Yes, and it has been. And adoption of the IHRA definition of anti-Semitism is one of my top diplomatic asks overseas. I mean, if a country hasn't, that's one of the things we request. It is so important because to have an objective definition is key. You have to identify the problem in order to combat it. And by the way, this has nothing to do with censorship. Again, the anti-Semites always yell freedom of speech whenever you try to call them out for being anti-Semites, as though, by the way, they're the only ones who have freedom of speech. We don't have freedom of speech to actually condemn them. They have freedom of speech to spout hate. It's absurd. You know, this has nothing to do with censorship. It has to do with understanding what anti-Semitism is and how it manifests. So you can condemn it appropriately. And the power of the IHRA definition of anti-Semitism is that in addition to providing sort of an overarching definition, it lists some 10 or 11 examples of modern manifestations of anti-Semitism that not only cover traditional, you know, Jews control the world, Jews are responsible for, you know, every problem we have. You mentioned the pandemic earlier, you know, classic. But it also encapsulates more contemporary manifestations of anti-Semitism, like, you know, comparing Israel to the Nazis, anti-Semitism, you know, suggesting that the Jewish people have no right to self-determination, by suggesting that the creation of the State of Israel is a racist endeavor. That's an example of anti-Semitism, subjecting Israel to a double standard not exacted of any other democracy, an example of anti-Semitism. The power of the IHRA definition is it allows us to point to a particular statement, a particular movement, and say, look, what you're doing is anti-Semitism. It's not my opinion. It's an accepted definition. It's anti-Semitism. Are you aware of that? You know, sometimes people are not even aware of their seduction, I'll call it seduction, by truly hate-filled anti-Semitic movements. You know, BDS is a classic example. Some people are seduced into this, and they don't realize that singling out the one Jewish state is anti-Semitism. And so it helps educate people, you know, because many people don't want to be anti-Semitic. And those that want to be anti-Semitic and are actively trafficking in this, well, it allows us to say, look, this is anti-Semitism, and we're going to call you out on it. Don't think we're not going to say it is. It's very, very important. And it is a game changer, like you said. Every single day, it's not a day that goes by that we're not taking heat. And we're doing it anyway. There's no doubt, by the way. There's no doubt or equivocation, because it's the right thing to do.
There's an oft-repeated saying, there's never a wrong time to do the right thing. But it's also a fact that doing right is seldom easy. In the fight to stem the rising tide of anti-Semitism from many different corners, we are fortunate to have people like Special Envoy Carr doing the right thing. It was moving to hear from him how much the legacy of my father, the foundation's namesake, Tom Lantos, still affects him and helps guide his work.
It's not only his history that's powerful. It was every aspect of him was powerful. He exuded command and authority and fire and brimstone eloquence. He opened his mouth, you could hear a pin drop. It was riveting to hear him speak, riveting. And what's even more important about him than all of that is how he employed his prodigious talents. It was always toward principle. It was always for making the world a better place, truly tikkun olam. I thought of him as a moral compass, a voice of conscience for our country. He's not the only one, thank God we have voices of conscience for our country, but he really was something else. And, you know, one of my heroes. Please know that he continues to inspire me every day. And I always, in my work, am mindful that I have to be worthy of the post I hold that he played a central role in creating. That motivates me every day. And so thank you, and thank you to the Lantos Foundation for all of the good work that you do.
That was Ilan Carr, U.S. Special Envoy to monitor and combat anti-Semitism. I'm grateful to Special Envoy Carr for taking the time to speak with us and for his tireless work in the fight against anti-Semitism. We have more episodes from our special season coming soon, including interviews with people on the front lines of this fight.
What concerns me is the internet. These are the highways of hate, of all sorts, murderous hate, of all kinds.
And firsthand accounts from Holocaust survivors.
I heard a footstep next to my head, and I looked up, and there was a big black boot, and then the bayonet came down.
I hope you'll join us for the rest of the episodes from our Solidarity Sabbath podcast season. Make sure to subscribe to The Keeper on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. That way you won't miss anything. I'm Katrina Lantos-Sweat, and thank you for listening to The Keeper.
This episode of The Keeper was produced and recorded by the Lantos Foundation for Human Rights and Justice. To support our work, and for more information on today's topic, visit us at www.lantosfoundation.org.